The question about yesterday's title, the Thunderbolt Perfect Mind, is that on top of the document?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, can you go a little, say anything more about that? I mean, Perfect Mind's a Buddhist.
Not much more than I can say about what I did yesterday. Most of the titles of all of these are kind of goofy.
Really?
For instance, for that one, the Thunder Perfect Mind, none of those words, well, the word mind occurs in the text, but nothing else. There's nothing about thunder.
Was there already a title on that manuscript? Was it one that the monks added in later?
No, basically, most hardly anything that people write are given titles by the authors.
So did that have a title? Because if they didn't find it till 1945, who would have given it the title?
Well,
the translator?
The copyist. So, in other words, so Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in the earliest copies, they don't have titles.
Well, how long, the documents, the actual papyruses, what age did they think about that they were copied over or whatever?
Yeah, so all different kinds. So this is, yes. This is really...
that particular one.
That one. So, the Thunder Perfect Mind, that is dated to the 4th century.
Okay, so they would have had copiers over the years that threw that title on it.
Well, see, the thing is that, for instance, the oldest copy of, let's say, the Gospel of Mark is from the 4th century.
Okay.
So we don't, we have almost the first scrap of a book from the early Christ people is from the first part of the second century, and that's a piece of papyrus about that book.
Oh, it's the whole, not the whole.
I mean, exactly.
It's the whole.
And so, in other words, so most manuscripts from the New Testament, as well as these others, are dated to from between the 4th to the 8th century.
Okay. So when was the Nicene Creed?
The 4th century.
So were these hidden away in response to those times, or?
So these are all questions that I no one knows.
Oh, okay.
But I guess I would want to say, but I would want to say this. So back to the first piece. We have no original manuscripts of any text inside or outside.
Could you grab one?
Sure. And, so that's one thing to know. The other thing is that, and then the other big thing to know is that the New Testament, we don't quite know how it was even decided, what was in the New Testament or not. There's really no clear decision. Or that is, one would say probably by the middle of the, by the end, beginning of the 6th century, most people have know there's something called the New Testament. That's 500 years.
Okay.
And the thing about that is that at that point, you can't make books that big. So even when you have, in the, say, the beginning of the 6th century, in the 500s, even though you have something that many people are calling the, I thought there was a little group, so I'll turn around. So even then, in the 6th century, when people know that there is something called the New Testament, there is no book, because you can't make books that big. It takes to the about the 8th to the 9th century before you can actually make a book called the New Testament. But then, getting back to your initial question, about the title of The Thunder Perfect Mind? Well, it's basically, we assume that this one copy we have in the Jesus jar is not the original. Almost certainly it's a copy, but we don't know, since it's the only one, we don't know how far back it gets. So that one little piece of the earliest piece of the of a book in the New Testament that we have that's in the second century is just a tiny little piece. That's from the Gospel of John. But we don't have a complete Gospel of John until a copy of the complete Gospel of John until the fourth century. So this, and then the other thing, I mean, I'm getting off the track, but we'll talk about Thecla in a minute. So if, and how do we decide what is, what, let's say, what the gospel book says? We have perhaps the gospel Luke, maybe 90 manuscripts in the first 1,000 years. The first one is about the fourth century. But all of these manuscripts have different versions. So it's not the same exact text. So when we decide what we're going to print as, say, the Gospel of Luke, scholars have to go through and compare all of these 90 manuscripts to see which ones they think are right. And so none of them are completely right. And none of them are completely wrong. So you have to look in detail. I should bring this afternoon, I can get one from over there. So if you look at the Greek New Testament, at the bottom of every page you have the variations of all of the texts. So that, in other words, because the people who put Bibles together are just doing their best, but different publishers print different versions of each book.
So the phrase, the inerrant word of God, is pretty shallow.
It's a little funny. Yeah, it's a little funny. So in as much as you want to say that, which is the inerrant, basically even the evangelicals are arguing with each other, among each other, as to which manuscripts you think are the best. So yeah, when somebody waves the Bible in their hand and says, this is it, you know that there's kind of some give and take.
They probably haven't had a whole lot of biblical study background.
Well, you know, there are really great evangelical scholars of manuscripts who know this, the fact that it's crazy hard. So in other words, there are evangelicals who know all this and are trying to figure out which is the best. But the interesting thing is they don't agree among themselves. And so, for instance, I would, I'm sure, agree on one page of the Gospel of John with a evangelical scholar and on the next page with a liberal scholar. And it's not because not necessarily just because they're liberals or conservatives or whatever. It's just because it's hard to figure out. I'm working with a person right now who's discovered what we think is the earliest complete version of the Gospel of John. And that, the earliest one we've now discovered just in the last 30 or 40 years, it has, for instance, in the story of Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, there's no Martha at all.
Well, who made lunch?
So, in other words, and the Mary sounds a lot like Mary Magdalene rather than Mary Bethany.
Fascinating.
When was this version of John? What's the attributed time when that
is late third.
Third century. Yeah. And John was the last gospel that was written, isn't that believed?
You know, it's that's what I was taught in seminary, and I have changed my mind. There's a bunch of people, we now think probably Luke is the last.
Luke?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, as I said yesterday morning, I may be lying. it's hard to tell. Well, let's talk a little bit about Thecla. So you all have the entire book in front of you. If someone doesn't, I've got plenty of copies. Just a word about this as a text. So it's called the Acts of Paul and Thecla, but here, because of what I just said about manuscripts not agreeing, there are many different very early copies of a book called the Acts of. Some of them call it the Acts of Paul, some of them call it the Acts of Thecla, the majority of them call it the Acts of Paul and Thecla. So we don't even know whether there was an Acts of Thecla before there was an Acts of Paul and Thecla, or an Acts of Paul before there was an Acts of Paul and Thecla. So that's confusing. But since most of them call it the Acts of Paul and Thecla and have that story in them, we're going with this. And on Friday, for those of you who are here, I went quickly through this story. I'm hoping to just stay with the story a little bit longer, because it's a pretty long story. It may take us 20 minutes to go through it just in as an overview. And again, what I want to say is what I said yesterday, too. I'd encourage us to think of this as a story that wants to make meaning of things, not as a history. That doesn't mean that there's not history in it, but since this is a real story of somebody, it's a little different than The Thunder Perfect Mind, who those of you who were listening about that yesterday, because that's kind of a poem. It's sort of less at stake when you have a poem as to whether it's historical or not. This is a story of people. One might say real people, but I don't know how real. and that can be said, of course. A number of you know that I was one of the founding members of this institution called the Jesus Seminar, and we worked through all of the inside and out, the canonical and non-canonical stories about Jesus, to see what was historical and what wasn't. We worked for about 15 years on that, and got a lot of ink in the process. So I've been very interested in those questions, but I'm not sure that one can ever know. We try. So Paul and Thecla starts with, let's just look at it. It starts with Paul. And Paul is going around, and in chapter 1, Paul is encountered by two fellow travelers who were involved in his movement, or somebody's, a movement about Jesus. And these are Demas and Hermogenes. And Demas and Hermogenes don't like Paul. And so they have an argument throughout about the first 10 chapters of this. Paul critiques Demas and Hermogenes, and they critique him. So the story begins with an argument. And then Paul travels around a little bit in chapters 2 and 3. And then he stays at the house of Onesiphorus. That's in chapter 4 and 5. And then in 5 and 6, something, I think, for us to... In Onesiphorus' house, they have a meal, and Paul starts talking. And so, you know, so we have a bunch of letters of Paul. In the New Testament, we think, most scholars think, that there are 7 authentic letters of Paul, and there are 4 others who are not written by Paul, but they say they're written by Paul. The interesting thing about what is here is none of this is in either the authentic letters of Paul or the second generation letters of Paul. So just let's read out loud at least chapter 5. I'll start and then somebody can pick up. And when Paul entered into Onesiphorus' house, there was great joy and kneeling and breaking of bread and the word of God concerning self-control and resurrection. Concerning self-control and resurrection. And as Paul said, blessed are the clear of heart, for they will see God. Blessed are those who observe purity in flesh, for they will become a temple of God. And we'll continue.
Blessed are the self-possessed, for God will speak to them. Blessed are those who set themselves apart from this world, for they will please God. Blessed are those who have wives as if they do not, for they will be heirs of God. Blessed.
Yeah, go ahead, take a second.
Blessed are those in awe of God, for they will become messengers.
Well, let's stop here for a minute. Any questions?
Yes, Chris. Well, yeah. It sounds like one of those movements that Paul was always preaching against or something.
It's quite a different... Well, it's an interesting question. It's some different than Paul's own letters. On the other hand, for instance, Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 defends celibacy. And says almost exactly the same thing. Notice in verse 5, blessed are those who have wives as if they do not, for they will be heirs of God. In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, he says, you know, it's better not to marry, but there's a possibility if you are married that you don't have intercourse. And those who do marry, it's probably good if you stay married, but maybe you want to stay married and be celibate. And I, by the way, Paul says, I'm celibate. So this is sort of like that and sort of not like that. So, and by the way, in this book, celibacy is going to be a really interesting issue. So if we ask, did Paul promote celibacy? In his letters, the answer is probably yes, but was kind of nuanced about it because he said it was all right to be married. This Paul we're not going to be quite so sure as to whether it's okay to be married. Let's read 6. Somebody want to pick up and say. Oh, Christy, close to your question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Blessed are the ones who tremble at God's words, for they will be called. Blessed are the ones who receive the wisdom of Jesus Christ, for they will be called children of the highest. Blessed are the ones who keep their baptism, for they will rest with the Father and the Son. Blessed are those on the journey to uniting with Jesus Christ, for they will be in the light.
Somebody else pick up there?
Blessed are the ones who have departed the form of the world through God's love, for they will judge angels, and at the right hand of the Father, they will be praised. Blessed are the compassionate, for they will receive compassion, and will not see the day of grievous judgment. Blessed are the bodies of maidens, for they will have favor with God, and will not lose the reward of their holiness, for the Father's word will be a work of salvation for them until the day of his child, and they will have rest forever.
Thank you. Let's stop there. So just a question. So in the New Testament, someone is known for speaking, blessed are, right?
Mm-hmm.
And who's that?
Jesus.
Jesus, right.
Yeah.
So that's the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain in Luke. But here, this kind of speech is Paul. The thing that is important to notice here is that we have in the seven authentic letters of Paul, that is the ones we're pretty sure are really, he never speaks like this. Okay, so we're getting a little picture of Paul. We're going to now turn the corner in chapter 7. And here we get to meet that one. And Paul said these things in the middle of the association in Onesiphorus' house. A certain maiden, Thecla, whose mother was Theoclea and was promised in marriage to a man, Themiris, sat at a window close to the house and listened night and day to the message about holiness spoken by Paul. She did not turn away from the window, but moved forward in faith, rejoicing exceedingly. And yet, having seen many women and maidens coming to Paul, she also desired for herself to be deemed worthy to stand face to face with Paul and hear the word of Christ, for she had not yet seen Paul in person, but only heard his word. Pretty clear is the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she's in the house listening to Paul preach outside, or teach outside is probably the better word. And what's Paul known for in this city? Lots of maidens and women are coming to him. So, we just as well stop here for a minute and think about that. So, how much that's historical or not is not clear. What is quite clear is when this book is written in the second century, Paul wrote in the first century, but this is a book about Paul. When this book was written, it's true that many of the Christ movements were attracting women, attracting unmarried women, widows, and women who weren't quite sure they wanted to be married, although they were. So, for instance, one of the things that Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians, is trying to help them decide is a bunch of the women are saying, you know, we're married, but actually we don't think we're going to act like we're not. So, what's up here? Most folks say that the many women who come to the early movements of Christ are coming out of the difficulty of what it means to be a woman in those days, especially relative to marriage. Because, of course, marriage is, by and large, a relationship in which one's not only not in charge of one's life, but one's husband is in charge of the life. In many places, the wife is considered to be the property of the man. And if you don't get married, there's no way of you being guaranteed protection. There is danger in not being married and danger in being married. So something is happening in the early Christ movement to encourage people, women, mostly women, some men, not to get married. So this story is right at the heart of that. Here is Thecla as a part of a bunch of women. She wants to be like all these other women who are coming to Paul to learn what it might be like not to get married. And that mostly means, not to have sexual intercourse at all, we think. The thing about that is, it's really difficult to know exactly what it means. What it is quite clear, as we'll see a little bit later in the story, is that if you have a public life, to be in public is alone, and be on your own alone as a woman is pretty dangerous. So some of these people are becoming members of communities of the Christ. Thecla, as we'll see, she wants to be like, she's just said it, she wants to be like Paul. She wants to teach and heal. So, okay, let's find what happens. Then in 8, her mother and her fiancé find out what's happened, that she's enamored of Paul. And they say, hey, Thecla, you're already engaged to be married. And Thecla just keeps staring out at Paul. Thamyris, the mother, is very upset, and she thinks that her daughter has had a spell in chapter 9 put on her by Paul. Thamyris is her betrothed. Theoclea is her wife. Both Theoclea and Thamyris, mother and fiance, are against this and try to force her to go ahead and get married. And you look in 10, and Thamyris went to her, because he's her fiancé, at once loving her and also fearing her passion. He said, Thecla, my betrothed, why do you sit like this? What is the emotion that binds you in passion? Turn toward your Thamyris and be ashamed. And her mother also said the same things to her. Child, why do you look down and sit like this, answering nothing but acting like a mad person? And they cried desperately. Thamyris for the loss of his wife, Theoclea for the loss of her child, and the maidservants for the loss of their mistress. And so there was great confusion and mourning in the house. And while these things were happening, Thecla did not turn back, but was fixed to the word of Paul. All right. We got 43 chapters here. So what happens next is Thamyris and Theoclea take her to court, bring her to the judge, and they get Paul arrested for causing this. So clearly this seems like Thecla is probably maybe more wealthy than all of these other women following Paul. And her mother and her betrothed are wanting to stop this, at least for her. And in the next 5 chapters or so, what happens is Paul is imprisoned for endangering young women. And Paul is locked up. Thecla hears it, steals some jewelry from home, or takes her own jewelry from home, and bribes the jailers so that she can go in and sit next to Paul in jail. And there, she even kisses Paul's chains. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? So is she, in the telling, is she really kind of in love with Paul? She's not saying that, but kissing his chains is a little interesting in that regard, right? So finally, they take Paul and Thecla back to court, and they kick Paul out of the town. They beat him, and they send him away. But Thecla, they say she is worthy of death. And so they decide that they will burn Thecla at the stake. Let's find it. That is. There's a long. And so in chapter 18, she brings the bracelets, and then in 20, Paul's in court, and then 21, the governor condemns Thecla. And then in 22, like, we can read this, and the young men and the young women brought firewood, wood, and straw that Thecla might be burned. And as she came naked, the governor wept and marveled at the power in her. And the executioners laid out the firewood and ordered her to climb upon the pyre. And she made the sign of the cross. As she made the sign of the cross, she climbed upon the firewood. They lit it, and a great fire blazed, but the fire did not touch her. Let's back up just a little bit. Noticing here, so the governor, I can't quite write, somehow the governor weeps. This is because she has such power. That's also mentioned right next to her being naked. I don't know how that all arises. but of course, one of the signs of punishment, especially women, is to present them naked as humiliated. So here they're burning her naked. So, for God, having compassion, there's still in 22, caused a sound under the earth and a cloud filled with rain and hail, darkened from the sky from above, and the vessel poured all was and the vessel poured forth all that was in it. Many were in danger and died, and the fire was extinguished, and that one was saved. We're getting kind of the picture of the story. So now we're in the miracle territory, right? Mm-hmm. God's on her side. In the process, a bunch of people get killed. So now she's on her own, because her family wanted, decided that it would be better that she was killed rather than not be married. And now she's free, and then we get back to Paul. Paul's visiting somebody else, and then Paul comes, she finds Paul and says, "Hi, Paul." And he says, "Whoa! I thought you were going to die." and that's 23 and 24. But then they're rejoicing. And look at, if you would, at 25. This is pretty interesting. And there was much love in the tomb. tall rejoicing and Onesiphorus and all of them. And they had five loaves and vegetable and water and salt and rejoiced at the divine works of Christ. And Thecla said to Paul, I will cut my hair short and follow you wherever you go. Just a little commentary here. So this is what women in that day do if they're in public on their own. They look like men.
Oh.
So this is the best way to be safe, is to look like men. So she's saying, I got to do that because I want to do your work too. And he said, it is a shameful time and you are fair. So she seemed to be pretty. May other trials come upon you worse than this, and this time you are not, may no other trial come upon you worse than this first, and this time you are not able to stand firm, but are cowardly. So he's worried if she's going out to be a Christ teacher, that she's not going to have courage enough. And she says, in verse 5, only give me the seal of Christ and no trial will touch me. Isn't that a great answer? So listen, if you baptize me, Christ is going to be with me and it's going to be okay. And he says, have patience and you will receive the water. That's a polite no. Right? This is a really interesting relationship between Paul and Thecla. Notice there's some happiness with one another. They seem to work together, and beginning to work together here. He's worried about it, but he's not going to baptize her, which she says would be the seal that would make her safe. So then she goes off, and they separate. So she hasn't been baptized, but she's now doing the work. But she goes to Antioch, a big city, relatively far away, and the first thing that happens to her as she's on the street is the person who is head of the regional council of government sees her on the street and falls in love with her. And he says, okay, I really need to have you as my woman. She knocks his crown off.
Literally his crown off.
Yeah,
his head.
Right, yeah.
In verse 7.
and he gets her arrested. Because she won't marry him.
Well,
and because he knocked his crown off. there's another scene in court, and this time she is condemned to die in the amphitheater in front of the beast. And at the same time, while she is while she's being prepared for the lions, she is put under the care of a rich woman in Antioch. But then she gets taken to the amphitheater, and we can pick that up in 33. Well, let's go to 32. And there was an uproar that were now in the amphitheater, and rumbling of wild animals, and a cry from the people, and the women sitting together, some saying, bring in the sacrilegious one, and others saying, let the city be destroyed for this lawlessness. Destroy all of it, proconsul, ferocious spectacle, evil judgment. So it's the women in the stadium who are now arguing with each other as to whether she's a hero or whether she should be killed. Quite a story, huh? How many of you have heard the Thecla story? So then Thecla is taken out of Tryphaena, which is the rich woman's hands, and stripped and received a girdle and was thrown into the stadium. And lions and bears were thrown in front of her, and a ferocious lioness charged her and then lay down at her feet. That's 33. And a bear ran up to her, but the lioness charged and met it and tore the bear apart. So not only the women are fighting about this, but the lions are fighting. And again, a lion that had been trained against humans, which belonged to Alexander, ran up to her, and the lioness engaged the lion, and the two were killed together. And the women mourned even more, since the lioness that helped her was dead. So this is kind of a gender contestation now, right? Not only are the men fighting the women, or this woman, but now the women are getting to be more and more on Thecla's side, and now it's the lioness fights the lions of the den. I want to get to a discussion, so I'm going to just tell you a little bit more. So then in this part of the story, basically all of the animals that are to kill her won't or don't. And the crowd is going crazy for and against her. And then they put a big pool of water in the middle of the stadium. And she says, "Wow, water!" And she runs and jumps in it. Why? Because she has decided to baptize herself. Right in the middle of the stadium. But there are, and I just can't figure this out. They put human-eating seals in the water. I've never heard of a human-eating seal. But they're supposed to kill her. But she then baptizes herself in the water, and God strikes a lightning bolt into the water and kills all the human-eating seals.
But isn't she already in the water?
Yeah. Doesn't kill her.
Okay.
Doesn't
just
kill her.
Sure.
Just her. Right? She's in the water. Right? And by this time now, it's clear to the whole crowd that this is miraculous. And the governor starts getting afraid that, and the rich woman is in the crowd too, on her side. Mm-hmm. And the governor is afraid now that the emperor will hear that this rich woman is on her side, and that looks like sort of some divine powers are on his side. So the governor lets her go. Okay. Questions, thoughts?
Well, it's such a spectacle.
It is a spectacle and a half.
I mean, the crowds must have been going crazy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the timing of it, was the pool there to begin with, and did she just notice it, or
no? It says they brought it in.
Nobody had lunch or anything.
It just seems like you don't have the seals sitting around in the background. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the question would also be whether they have all the lions and all that, and how could there be a male versus female lion contest for her. Those are all big questions.
It seems like every time something happens to her, she becomes more elevated.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, more elevated and more powerful. Mm-hmm. So she leaves and goes back to her mother to reconcile with her mother. Mm-hmm. And her mother won't reconcile with her. Mm-hmm. So then she goes back to Paul, starts work, says, by the way, you don't need to worry about the baptism. And then they work together and apart for the rest of their life. She outlives Paul, because Paul is killed somehow. This story nor other stories know necessarily how Paul was killed. But she is, she dies of old age. At one point, late Elkhart, I'll read one last thing here. Look at 44, if you will. This is after she's had success. And here is another of these male attacks on her. But certain ones in the city, Greeks by religion and doctors by profession, sent violent young men to her to ruin her. That would be rape, right? For they said, she is a maiden and serves Artemis. Because of this, she has power with healing. And by God's foresight, she entered into a rock, alive, and it descended on the earth. And she left for Rome to see Paul and found him sleeping. So in other words, it's the earth this time that saves her. So a rock swallows her. And then she comes out of the rock and goes to see Paul in Rome.
Does sleeping mean that Paul is dead?
No, I don't think so. But I'm not. Sometimes it does.
Because it seems as though...
And after staying there a little while, she slept with a beautiful sleep. That is her dying.
Yeah.
And she is buried about 2 and 3 stadia from the tomb of her teacher, Paul.
So,
look at my
view. He's dead.
Yeah, but that's a good point.
So, is
her name in the other texts at all, or is this the only place where she appears?
Oh, no. Thecla is a hero.
In our New Testament.
The only document in a New Testament that has this story is there, but there are a bunch of other stories. She becomes really famous throughout the first 7 centuries. So they got the stories of Thecla get more and more.
But where is she in our New Testament that we have?
She's not.
Oh, she's not.
Not even her name.
Not her name is not.
Not mentioned. Okay.
Not mentioned at all.
Okay.
And which document is she first mentioned in the antiquity of the literature?
I think this is it. John Dominic Crossan, for instance, a leading scholar, says that there was an Acts of Thecla before there was an Acts of Paul and Thecla. Mm-hmm. But that's just us scholars guessing.
And where was the manuscript for this story found?
This manuscript is all, this in contrast to the others, this manuscript is all over the place. We have hundreds of copies and none of them agree. Mm-hmm. But for instance, I mentioned this on Friday afternoon, Irenaeus, who is a late 2nd century theologian, he says, in one of his writings, he says, listen, you all got to just get over Thecla. Just stop reading about Thecla. And whether that's because she baptized herself or because she was a woman who baptized, it's not quite clear, but he mentions baptism as one of the reasons why you're not supposed to pay attention to Thecla.
Well, it would have been a wonderful story, kind of like the an ancient day version of Superwoman.
It's a woman going against the traditions, and even Paul. I mean,
right.
Just a person.
And what would you say is the biggest thing she does that is, in this story, a problem?
A problem?
Defying authority.
Defying authority, but in what regard?
Shaming,
but it's marriage that's the issue.
No.
I mean, 2 times, so there are men that want to marry her, and she won't. And then the 3rd time, there's a gang of men that want to rape her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's saved.
But I guess she won't marry this guy. So they take her to court. She's ordered to death. Well, that's not a solution to having her marry the guy. It's a solution to him being embarrassed that she won't
marry. Oh, that's yes, in both cases.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. But I think it, I frankly want to say that it is part of the larger misogyny.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so, absolutely.
In other words, to punish her for mm-hmm. shaming the man is one thing, but it's not completely separate from her deciding that she doesn't want to marry at all. What's it really interesting in this, excuse me?
Probably makes an example of her.
Yeah, right. And that she lives an entire life and dies of old age means that she's successful in her lifestyle. In other words, a bunch of scholars of this larger movement of celibacy in the second century say that this is not about sex so much as about the Christ movements providing open space for women to not marry and to have another kind of life that is not under the authority of husbands. So that a number of works about that club, but about other women, are saying this is mostly about carving out a space for women not to marry.
I wonder how successful the communities were in caring for them. I mean, in keeping them safe and feeding them and everything. You know.
Well, it seems to be quite successful. And the history of that is a very clear one. That at first it's the communities, or what we would call the churches, that for whom they work, in whom they teach, and who protects them.
How is that different from a convent?
I was just getting there.
Oh.
Yeah, I was just getting there. So what basically then happens, however, by the third century is that institutions are created for these women. And there, it's an interesting set of questions. Does that increase or reduce their freedom?
Because once again, the women will come under male domination of some sort.
Yeah, yeah. Although, of course, the institution of the convent from then until now has women ruling women.
Right. But ultimately,
right. But ultimately, but
they report up to
yeah.
The Pope.
And so, I guess I would want to say that. Let's say from
recently,
excuse me.
We've seen that recently that the Pope, and not this.
Yeah,
Pope,
this
one,
the last
Pope
really
came
said,
down on
them. I'm gonna crack down.
Nuns on the bus.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this Pope said there will never be women priests. Never. So.
Yep.
I know.
Yep.
I was surprised.
How can you say
that?
I mean, yeah, I was very surprised.
And so I think there's a possibility that in the third century, when the convents start to thrive, I don't think that there is church order enough to have male authority over them institutionally.
Right.
I think it takes us several centuries before that happens.
Like Ostergaard was friends with the Pope and communicated, I mean, they shared ideas.
Yeah, well, and that's much later. That's the 14th century.
Right, right. So, not always the case, yeah.
In other words, and then, by the way, so, for instance, in the 19th century, in Syria, there's this whole women's movement of women, thousands of women joining cloisters and convents. To get out of marriage and oppressive situations within the family. Because here the other issue at stake was basically daughters who don't get married, what happens to them? even under the best circumstances, they're under their father and their brothers at home. And so in the 19th century, Syria has this massive convent movement. And guess who is the patron saint? Thecla.
Really?
Well,
cool. So I was wondering if she was canonized.
Yes, she is canonized.
Yeah, why in Syria?
In the Coptic Church?
No, the Roman and
the...
Roman and Syrian.
I did hear the name then.
Yeah. No. She is celebrated widely in Roman.
I'm surprised they haven't made a movie of her. It sounds like a great movie. They have the beautiful woman and all these things.
And not so much sex, but at least nudity.
Yeah.
And plenty of handsome, you know, challengers to
What does Paul consider recommending or recommending men being, if they're married, being acting like they're not married? As well as women, I can kind of understand a little bit where he's going with that, I think.
Well, but see, Paul himself is celibate. And Paul says, there's too much work to be done for the sake of Christ for you to be married. And so
all men though? He says it to all men?
Well, he has a compromised position. He says if you can stay married, you can stay married and be sexually active. You can stay married and not be sexually active. Or you cannot get married. And this is almost certainly that in Corinth, because this is only in the first letter to the Corinthians that this material comes to light. Paul is almost certainly meeting churches of Corinth who have women leaders and who are saying, we're acting as if, some of them don't have husbands, and those who do are saying, we're going to be celibate.
Huh. Why is there no mention of her in the books of the New Testament?
Yeah.
What was going on in the minds of, who was the guy? Who was the church father?
Irenaeus, yeah.
Irenaeus.
Actually, Tertullian says something similar.
Oh yeah, well that would make sense.
But
that story would be deemed as a protest against authority. Was that the main psychological thing that was going on in their minds, that they would have excluded the story from?
Well, no. I mean, well, I see the problem with this question about canon is we have no story of who made the canon up. In other words, well, that's not quite true. There is one all-church council that endorses the New Testament. That's the Council of Trent. Anyone know when the Council of Trent was? 1500s. And that's not because of any of these ancient controversies. It's because Luther is messing with the New Testament. Luther wants... the revelation to John and James to be kicked out.
But weren't there other earlier, circa 300 AD, the discussions in the literature?
There is some in the 4th century, and in seminary I was taught that the New Testament came into being in 360 when a bishop in North Africa wrote a Easter letter to his diocese in which he listed 27 books that they should read with special authority. And those are the same 27 that we have now in the Western Church. But it was just an Easter letter from one bishop. It wasn't anybody saying, he didn't say this is for all this church. He says, it's for my diocese.
Okay.
But I was taught in seminary that that's when the New Testament came into being. And there are three regional councils, that in the 4th century, not all church councils, but, you know, like a what we would call a synod, a regional council, three of them were reported to have also endorsed the 27 books of our current New Testament. We have there are no notes taken from there. It's all second and third hand that they did that. So we don't know what happened at, for instance, the Synod of Hippo.
And we can be sure no women were at these things.
Well, no. Well, I think it, frankly, is much more random. I think it's just that nobody said, let's keep notes for the Synod of Hippo.
No, I guess what I meant was in deciding, trying to decide.
But see, what I'm saying is that we don't even have authority saying this is the New Testament. Right. The closest we have is in the 5th century, one of the major authorities of translating, Jerome is his name, he's translated all of the Old Testament, and then there are all these other things, and he is translating this here's the thing, he's translating it into Latin, because everything's in Greek, right? Because by that time, Rome is centrally in authority, and Europe is starting to read this stuff, and they read it in Latin. So Jerome is the first person who says, now which ones in Greek do I have to translate? And so he puts out the 27. So that's really the first or the only authority we have that says this is what's in the New Testament. What's clear? Well, it's not quite clear. So we have copies of the Bible, right? From about the 8th century on. If you look at the Bibles from about 800 to 1400, 90% of them have 27 books in them of the New Testament. 10% have some others. Various others. So
what were the other books that were excluded from the 27? Just is there a consistency?
Yeah, one of them is a document called the Letter of Paul to Laodicea. Another is Apostolic Constitutions, which was, and actually the Apostolic Constitutions we have the entire text of that, but that was written in the 5th century itself. And it said what's supposed to be in the New Testament is not 27, but 26, it didn't like the revelation of John, and 8 books that we just read, or that we just wrote. So the Apostolic Constitution says there should be 34 books, 26 of which are ancient, and 8 in which we just added. So there are a bunch of different, so it's not just one argument, but a number of different ones. We got back into the question of the books. But any last minute questions or thoughts about Thecla herself? As I said on Monday, I said on Friday in our first session, I said much of Christians throughout all of the centuries know Thecla. It's just the Protestants that don't know her. So, in other words, the Catholics will often know her.
You know, the miracles about her are all about her surviving terrible things. There's no miracles of her doing anything for anybody.
It says that she's a healer, but we have no stories.
Yeah, that's kind of too bad.
Yeah.
Is the reason the Protestants don't know her so well is because the Catholic Church made her a saint, but Protestants don't regard any particular people as saints as much? Or rather that we regard each other as saints as well.
I think it's that she ends up being one of the central Catholic figures about celibacy. Mm-hmm. And Protestants don't like that. Mm-hmm. So I would guess, and that's really total guessing, but when you hear this story, one of the thread lines of the story itself is, look, she's still celibate. Mm-hmm. And then as all of the other stories that grow up around this tend to be making her a saint because she is celibate.
She showed her power.
She showed her.
The governor, I think when he says he noticed her power, I think what I read there is he is seeing that she refuses to be humiliated.
Right.
Yeah. She's standing up for, and as a matter of fact, thinking back to Jesus, it's sounding to me now like what he was really trying to do was oppose slavery. Mm-hmm. In many forms.
Yeah. And this is one of them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so unfortunately the what she had to do to accomplish that was to become celibate.
Yeah, no, that
might not have been necessary if people weren't so hot on marriage.
Right, yes. Because marriage was a kind of institution that enslaved men.
Yeah.
Or women.
Or women.
From sort of a contemporary person's perspective, she seems to have overcome the challenges of a call ministry. I mean, aside from the sexuality issue.
Yeah.
So that you know, kind of puts her... I could see some young women in our congregation who are, you know, protesting out, marching in the streets and stuff. You know, they have a lot of power.
Yeah, and it's really interesting as a person of power, it's interesting how a more secular people now, what they would really think of her. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's hers is a part of a kind of an innovation, of a kind of innovative sexual identity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how many nuns you know, but a lot of nuns I know these days say, of course I'm sexual. It's another kind of sexuality. Mm-hmm. Celibacy is another kind of sexuality.
Yeah.
The nuns I know are no longer in the order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they had classes in sexuality. We knew a Yanni Shven, and she's... Well, of course we have classes in sexuality because we're sexual creatures, so we need to understand that.
I should let you go.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
4 o'clock for the last, for the Gospel of Truth.